In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with writer Alan Gurganis. He is the author of two novels. Maybe people will know him best for his first one, The Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All. He has also written another, Plays Well with Others, a collection of stories and novellas titled White People, and a new one that is a collection of four novellas that's just recently been published. It's titled The Practical Heart, and it's published by Knopf. He is now spending some time traveling around the country talking about the book and talking about his writing. He's in Chicago, and this morning he's joining us by telephone. Just a couple of other things here about him. He was recently inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the Fellowship of Southern Writers. A couple of the novellas that are in The Practical Heart have been previously published. I think there's one that has not appeared before. The Practical Heart, the title piece, won the National Magazine Prize after having been published in Harper's, and two of them have been optioned for feature films. As we talk this morning with Alan Gurganis, if you have questions you'd like to call in and talk with him, you can do that very easily by dialing us up here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Gurganis, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us again.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
I appreciate it. And also, I should mention, too, that in Chicago, you're going to be doing a reading and a signing at Barbara's Bookstore at 1100 Lake Street tonight, 7:30.
That's
so,
right.
So people
out in Oak Park, yeah.
Who are, there may be a few folks there up in the Chicago area who are listening. So it'd be an opportunity to meet the author. Hear from him and pick up a copy of the book. The contradiction in terms of the title, which is the title of the book and title of one of the stories, I think points to what it is, perhaps, that the characters, and they're all rather different, the characters in these four short novels, what it is that they have in common. What is that, you think?
I think we're almost practical about being impractical in a strange way, David. And I think that each of us at our healthiest have a kind of active fantasy life that keeps us going. What I've concentrated on in this book is a group of folks who develop a kind of interior reality, a kind of secret code, a kind of secret world. And at first the world is meant to protect them from the larger world, but eventually when it's challenged, they wind up cashiering the bigger world in for the private world. I think all of us are extremely aware right now of the difference between public life and private life, and given the recent events of the world, it almost feels as if our private lives have been sucked out the window, as it were. And so I really wanted to concentrate on how it is that we each develop a kind of personal mythology. And each of these characters in this assemblage is a champion of one child or another. All of them are people who look after other people. And those are the folks in the world that interest me most. I think a lot of books today are about bad people doing terrible things and getting away with it. And I'm interested in something that is much closer to home, at least in the way that I live, which is good people trying to do the very best they can and sometimes failing comically. But that seems to be the way I try to live my life. And though it's harder in a way to write about good people than bad people, it's also more satisfying for the reader because I think that describes more people in the world.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit about The Practical Heart, which is a story. Well, actually, it's two stories about the same character.
That's right, and it has the merit of being set in Chicago. For me, as the son of a Chicago native who grew up in North Carolina, Chicago was the first great city that I ever experienced as a young kid. And my mother's family came here in a particular and peculiar way. My great-grandfather was a professor of literature at the University of Glasgow and fell in love with cowboy novels, especially those written by a German named Karl May, who turns out to have made up his America out of atlases and maps and dictionaries, and while in prison wrote up to 60 novels about Indians and cowboys. My great-grandfather in Scotland read these, was very taken with them, and as a result moved his wife and four daughters to the boomtown Chicago of the 1870s. It was not at all the glossy, sophisticated, beautiful city it is today, at least for people who were used to living in a European reality. It seemed extremely raw, and I described the Civil War veterans with their emptied legs and arms of the blue uniforms pinned up, begging on the streets, the women under the street lamps, generally for sale, and the smell of the stockyard bringing reality to the most elevated thought. It was after spending a year in Chicago and feeling extremely homesick for Scotland that our particular family tragedy happened. My great-grandmother was rushing to get on a streetcar after buying presents at Marshall Fields for Scottish relatives and was struck by the streetcar and, in the way of the 19th century, rendered an invalid for life. So my grandmother and her three sisters all had to go out into the world to earn a living, which was something that would not have happened to them in Scotland. Mm-hmm. What I tried to do in this piece is, in section one, compensate my great-aunt Muriel, who was my favorite, for all she had given up on account of this accident and on account of being stranded in the States. And my gift, my reward to her, was being painted by the greatest portrait painter of the period, John Singer Sargent, who resided in England and had painted all the most glamorous people in the world and the most distinguished. So I've somehow given my family a kind of bouquet in absentia. I describe how Muriel is painted by Sargent and how the portrait is a watercolor that's in some ways more particular and more beautiful than lots of the portraits of Mrs. Potter Palmer and the Mrs. Armour in the Art Institute of Chicago. Though, of course, it's a fictional picture. And a few years ago at a party, I ran into the woman who's in charge of art reproductions for the Art Institute, who told me that every year they have up to 20 and 30 requests for the portrait of my great aunt in its collection. So I feel that having invented this, I've somehow compensated her for much of what she lost in this particular family sadness. She became my mentor, my fairy godmother, and brought me up summers to go to the Art Institute and attend concerts. And in a way, I feel that she created me as an artist. And so to be able to give something back to her at this point is a tremendous pleasure, David.
This novella is, as I said, it's these two stories. The first story is the one that you have just sketched out. The second is about the relationship between the narrator and his great aunt, and the visit to Chicago. And I'm interested in exploring this idea of how much of this is fact and how much of this is fiction. And I know that writers, I know it irritates them because readers want to look at it or do look at writings and they want to say, this is you, right? This actually happened to you. But it has such a feeling to me of something that must have happened. And I don't, and maybe it's because I too have stood inside the human heart at the Museum of Science and Industry,
right?
That you write about that in the story, the narrator and great aunt Muriel go to the Science and Industry Museum. And that's such a remarkable metaphor. Someone might think, you had made it up, except, of course, if you're a kid or a grown-up, you've been to the Museum of Science and Industry, you know there is, in fact, an enormous human heart, and you can walk through it. With me, it really registered, and it just felt, I thought as I'm reading about it, this is not fiction.
Right.
This happened to Alan Gerganis. He must certainly have had a great Aunt Muriel who took him to the museum, just as the story says.
That's right. Well, I reserve the right to say yes completely to your question. I mean, this is part of the mystery of art, is that often the facts that seem most invented, like a streetcar accident involving Scottish forebears in Chicago in the 1870s, seems extremely improbable, is actually so. And other details that are more mundane are invented over that. So what I've done in this particular novella, which is the most autobiographical of the four, is take the facts and shape them. But I felt that pulsating human heart in the Museum of Science and Industry, for me as a little bitty kid, was terrifying. It was like something out of science fiction. I was not sure that it was going to surrender me on the other side of the aorta if I ever entered it. And I think that became an instant and immediate metaphor for what it means to enter another person's heart and to allow another person access and the secret punch codes to our own. Mm-hmm. And the fact that my aunt led me to that and knew that I would be in awe of that fills me with gratitude. Another example of her generosity to me, and I feel very lucky in being one of those people who has had great teachers and mentors. Another example is that I came from this little town of 24,000 people in eastern North Carolina, a very isolated place, tobacco country, and flew up my first air flight when I was 4 or 5, a big adventure when everybody wore coats and ties to travel. I sound like I was born in the 19th century, and in a way I feel I was. Increasingly, I feel I was. And I liked it there. I loved it there. But my mother was a school teacher, retired to have kids, and she was one of those people who had many, many sets of encyclopedias all over the house. We didn't have huge luxuries, but the luxuries were always those of self-improvement and those of intellectual advancement. So my favorite volume was of Compton's encyclopedia was P for painting. And in the encyclopedia, there was a reproduction of a picture from the Art Institute, the Great Surat, Sunday Afternoon at the Island of Grand Jatte, which, as you remember, is about 35 feet long and about 12 feet tall, and it's just bigger than most walls of most rooms. And it was reproduced in my little encyclopedia in color, but about the size of a postage stamp, a commemorative stamp. And so my aunt was leading me alone around the museum as if it were her house, which she really felt it was, and which I think we all feel of our great institutions. And I turned the corner, and I saw this picture that was bigger than any picture I'd seen at that point. And it was so familiar because I'd looked at it so many times, David, and suddenly there it was, just immense and powerful. And I felt as if some huge wind had caught me, and I literally staggered backwards from it and fell half against a bench, which sort of broke my fall. And I was the way those of us from not Chicago and not New York feel in the great metropolitan centers. I was very, very upset that I'd made a fool of myself, and I felt like a hick, and I felt embarrassed to have been overwhelmed. And I straightened myself up and sat on the bench and pulled myself into a respectable position. and feeling very ashamed. And I looked over, and my aunt was standing off to one side, crying, just sobbing with pleasure and emotion at what she brought about, this response from this little boy who had the temperament of an artist, if not the situation that would seem to be leading him in that direction. But it was she who was my guide. And for me, to come back to Chicago with this book is very, very moving and very, very personal. It's full of Michigan Avenue. It's full of the shops. It's full of everything I researched about the period in Chicago, and full of the armors and the potters and the people who bought those paintings and gave them to Chicago and made them available to little boys like me.
I'm sure the artist would have been very pleased to know that his painting had literally knocked you off of your
That's
feet.
That's right. It was like Paul on the road to Damascus. You know, I was like blinded by the light.
That's such a wonderful story. I think the other part of the story that I think is special is it suggests what sometimes a magical thing that sometimes can happen, particularly happens across generations, with people in families that seem to be soulmates, and particularly when you have a child that's born to parents and they somehow, you know, you ask yourself now, how exactly did this work out? Because parents and child seem to be so different. And sometimes if that child is lucky, he or she can find somebody else to connect with that is so like them. You'd think now here there has to be something genetic going on that managed to work its way through the generations and link these people up.
It's true. I mean, they say that talent skips a generation. And I always felt the way I think a lot of people do, closer to my grandparents and my great aunts than to my parents' generation. Part of it, I think, was that growing up after the Second War in that period of boom and prosperity, and having, as I did, three younger brothers, I managed to leave them out of my fiction, David. I mean, I remember them at Christmas, but when it comes time to write about little boys, I'm the only one in tow. I think I gave myself one brother in this book. But my parents were distracted. My parents were putting food on the table, three meals a day for all us eager eaters, and keeping us in shoes and keeping us in encyclopedias and, you know, keeping the heat going. And it's a big job and for middle-class folks. And so a lot of the psychic care and feeding, the instruction of the soul, the aesthetic consideration, was left out or left to people who wanted that. And I was extremely lucky in my aunt, who would send me art supplies and watercolor paper, and I would do pictures of her favorite dog and send them back at Christmas, and we would correspond, and it was a very loving connection with an unmarried woman of a certain age who was not anybody you would look at twice on the street, but who managed to give me that the tradition that would seem to have been lost when the family became stranded in boomtown Chicago. It was almost as if some connection had been refound. And I think part of the great pleasure of being an artist and being a writer is that you get to save certain stories. I think every listener of yours, David, will know that on those Sundays when families get together, there's always the what-if story, the personal story of if only grandfather had invested in Coca-Cola, you know, when he was offered 50% of the shares, or if only Aunt Minnie had got through Ellis Island, or if only. And this was my mother's family's story. And there's a huge satisfaction for me having used all my skill at making this a shape that pertains for other people. And the response to the story from its first appearing in part in Harper's some years ago has been extremely heartening. And for me and for my tribe, I feel very edified.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Alan Gurganis. The story that we are talking about here is one of four novellas that have been collectively published under the title The Practical Heart. It's recently out, published by Knopf, and the guest is spending some time traveling around the country talking about it. He's in Chicago, and we'll be giving a reading and a book signing at Barbara's Bookstore at 1100 Lake Street tonight at 7:30. And I think, Alan, where did you say that this... Well, Oak Park?
It's in Oak Park.
Oh, in Oak Park, okay. So for people who are that way and are listening, they can attend, and of course questions are welcome. And I hope you, if you can bear with us for a moment or two here, we need to harangue people a little bit about supporting the station. But we have an incentive here. I have one copy of The Practical Heart. It's the one that I've been reading. And what we're going to do is for people who will call in, we hope you'll make a pledge. You don't have to, but if you will call in and make a pledge, we'll enter the names in a drawing, and we'll pick one, and someone will get a copy. We'll get The Practical Heart, and I've enjoyed it very much, and I think that others might too. So that's our incentive to get people to call. Jack Brighton, our producer, is here. What is that number?
217-244-9455, and just make sure to tell the volunteer who answers the telephone that you'd like to be in the drawing for The Practical Heart, and we'll make sure that that happens. I was thinking that it's a real shame to have to interrupt this really interesting interview, but, you know, it'd be much worse if we had to do that every day with commercials, something that in public broadcasting we don't have to deal with. We can just go straight through, have a 50-minute conversation with a guest or guests about interesting books, ideas, issues, etc., and not have to interrupt that every 5 minutes or so, sometimes even more, with an advertising message. I mean, can you imagine doing the show having to deal with that? It'd be very difficult.
I really can't, and I guess that's why it is that I have kept doing this. I keep doing this for so long, and one of the great pleasures of doing it here, being able to have this kind, we have every day 2 50-minute conversations, and we can get into some depth. And just fairly recently, within the last, I don't know, year or so, I've started to talk to more people who write fiction, and I've really come to enjoy it. And I think it was something that I avoided for a while because I was just chicken. It sort of scared me. I don't know why exactly. But we've had some writers say some very interesting things about their work on the show. And again, it's something that I think we can do because we have this great piece of time that we can do whatever we want with it. But it's there, as we also often try to remind people, that's there because people support the station.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we can get away with not having advertisements because our listeners help us pay the bills. 44% of our budget paid for by individual contributions, some business contributions, but mostly it's individuals and families who call with their pledge when we go on the air like this and give out the phone number, 217-244-9455. Ali Kawa, one of our news reporters, is with Phone Volunteers and our Pledge Center. And how are we doing so far in getting those calls ringing?
We're just about $80 away from reaching $5,000 for the day. So that's just a couple of calls away. Two, actually, on the basic membership. Basic membership is just $40, and you'll get the one-year subscription to Patterns Magazine. So we just wanted to encourage everyone out there, if you listen to our station and you enjoy the programming you're listening to right now, enjoy the news programming, you should call in right now, 217-244-9455, and become a member.
Also, there is a couple from Champaign who will contribute $10 for every pledge received today. So if you make a pledge at the $40 basic membership level, that will actually yield us $50. And that will add up, actually, by the end of the day.
That's
so
right.
Make the call now, 217-244-9455.
All right. Thank you very much, guys. We'll continue here our conversation with Alan Gurganis. His novels are Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All and Plays Well with Others. He also has a collection of stories and novellas, White People, and the newest is four novellas. The title is The Practical Heart. It's published by Knopf, and he is in Chicago today. He's traveling around talking about the book and about his writing. And questions, too, are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I happened quite by chance to see the review of The Practical Heart in the New York Times recently, and the guy who did the review didn't like it. And one of the things that he had a problem with, and I guess I'm not sure I understand why he thought that it was a problem, but was the mixture of fact and fiction. You know, the fact that some of the stories had autobiographical elements, but that also there were parts that clearly were fiction. And I guess, as I said, I'm not sure why that's a problem. But I wonder, as you think about writing, how you think about this idea of mixing, say, your personal experience and other things that are made up.
Well, according to my definition, David, that is fiction. I mean, my feeling is that anything I have lived or anything I've seen or read, anything I've encountered in a movie or overheard in a restaurant, it's all fair game. Henry James says a writer is someone on whom nothing is lost, and that means that everything is admissible. The Times assigned my book of fiction to a biographer who had, you know, scared up everything he could possibly find about the literal facts of my life from the internet, and then tried to hold me accountable for my imagination and my invention as if I'd written my autobiography, and I haven't. I mean, as I said to you earlier, this is a starting point, but I have the option of inventing and legal lying, which is really what fiction is. And when one breaks short-term rules for the larger good, I mean, I think fiction really is a kind of dreaming. And just as we would not expect to be held responsible for the literalness of our dreams, in our dreams we fly, in our dreams we can live under the ocean for days at a time. It's not literally true, but it's profoundly true. It's true in answering higher wishes and yearnings, which is really what fiction is all about. What's odd is that I've never really been an autobiographical writer. I mean, I think we talked 12, 11 years ago about Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, mm-hmm. and that's a book that I took 7 years to write in the voice of a 99-year-old half-blind woman with a fifth-grade education whose husband was this last surviving soldier of the Civil War. And so I know what it's like to live in the skin of another. And also I know what it's like to cross gender barriers and racial barriers, to say mine and mean hers, to say I and mean she. And it's a great privilege, and it's a prerogative I don't want to surrender. And my old teacher John Cheever used to say, fiction is a form of memory imperfectly understood. And I think that all the writers who write fiction and you whom you've talked to will tell you that when it's really, really working, you seem to be living the life of your characters. They can surprise you and reverse themselves and betray you and shock you and seduce you in ways that have no precedent in your assigned life. I talk in The Practical Heart about history being not just assigned but also wished, and how art is history most livingly wished. And so I feel absolutely confirmed that my job is to write fables. Other people can write facts, and I think facts are profound, but they are much easier to know and walk around than fables are. And in the long run, if I can leave a pile of fables that will speak to people about our time, the confusions of our time, and what last in human connections, I've made my contribution. I was very edified by the review in the Chicago Trib of my book, which was quick to honor it as fiction. And it's the kind of review that every writer waits to hear, so I'm doubly happy to be in Chicago. It feels a little safer than New York right now.
Let's talk with a caller. We'll give the caller a chance to talk with you in Champaign on line number one right here. Hello.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I want to thank David. Thanks so much. I enjoy so many of your shows every day when I'm home doing things like cooking and folding laundry and things, and I appreciate your insightful comments. And to the guests, I really appreciate your writing about positive things and life experiences, and I think our world is way too full of works of fiction that that deal with the horrific and murder and so many very negative things, and I guess I'm not at all attracted to that kind of literature. And it was great to hear about your work because I wasn't familiar with it, and I really enjoyed hearing about your aunt and your relationship with her, and I think just such a marvelous thing that you appreciate that so much. It's really kind of inspiring and lovely. And
Thank you. And
my other comment is that one of my very favorite writers. I so much enjoy knowing that some of what she writes, she's writing from her heart and her life experience too. And I love knowing the part of her that's in her books and how that comes through her books. The fact that someone has an issue that you draw from your life experience to write your fiction, I think is, what an odd thing to question that or to have issues about that, because of course that's the most natural thing in the world. And, I'll hang up.
Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. It's strange that I think a lot of us, when we first start writing, feel that we have to go and climb the Himalayan range in order to have subject matter. And the more you really begin to look around, the more you understand that nothing will ever be more dramatic than your family in its full course of rage or adoration. What a family member will do to another family member, or the way we every day destroy and save and create each other, is in some ways more dramatic than having a catamaran up the Amazon or going to the North Pole. I mean, for me, that the adventure of getting out of bed every day and finding a way to make your path and go to work and honor your colleagues and do the PTA and all that, keep the lawn decent so the neighbors won't complain. There's something inherently heroic in that that's so easy to miss. But I think for me, as a son of the middle class, the real subject matter is that the nitty-gritty of the everyday. And if you can find a way to infuse that with the mythic, which is what it has to have if it's going to mean anything for us, then you really have addressed the folks like you and me who are folding laundry and getting on with our lives. I read a review this morning of a movie about Jack the Ripper, which is full of dismemberment and blood running in the streets and all that stuff, and I just thought, that might have been appropriate before September 11th, but all the reviewers are just revolted by this spectacle, and I think that a lot of things have changed. I'm in this interesting and dangerous position of flying to 15 cities in a row and looking into the faces of the readership in each of the towns, and I find that people are shaken, but also in the mode of inventory. They're thinking gratefully about what they have in their lives, not just what's been lost or what's taken away. And it's a real privilege to go to these cells. I think of if the Bin Laden faction is a cell, then God knows the readership in America is made up of hundreds of thousands of little cells of people who surround a certain bookstore and come to its readings and recommend things to each other and know each other and respect the sense of community that I think all of us are feeling right now. So I feel in a way like Johnny Appleseed traipsing about the country, scattering evidence and generation behind me. And it's a strange difficulty to get from town to town, but once you're in the presence of the readers at the university auditoriums or the bookstores, there really is a sense of safety and a sense of questioning that makes me very, very proud, not only to be a writer, but to be a reader in this culture.
We have another caller to talk with in Aurora, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I'm enjoying this program very, very much. I'm so glad to hear somebody speak to the everyday person, every woman or every man, and because really that's where most of us are. And there are the daily tasks that in my case have gone on for 10 years, and now the bringing up of a child of divorce, and that is very, very nitty-gritty. It's almost impossible, and you don't know where to turn to for answers, and that seems like every day I look for answers on how to make things better for her. And I really appreciate your speaking to what is really the multitude of people. And I wondered, asking you a question, what was your most fun book to write, or which book were you the happiest about writing, or felt the most fulfilled?
That's a great question. Thank you. Thank you for your call, and good luck with your mission of bringing up this kid. I think, we're living in this crazed celebrity culture where I seem to know more about Heather Graham's preference in sheets and food than I do about my brothers and sisters. And I think that there is a strange emphasis on those who are most visible and those who are most affluent and those who are least responsible for things like your kid and for just getting a child to school on time and keeping her away from the worst kids in the class and trying to encourage the best in her. I wrote Oldest Living Confederate Widow in the voice of a woman with 9 children, and I don't have kids myself, and just the act of writing in her voice for 7 years made me understand what it's like to make school lunches for a huge tribe of kids every day, every single day. All the head colds, all the notes from the teachers, all the paying off the neighbors when somebody throws a rock through a window, all that dailiness, which seems to go nowhere, but which I think in the hands of a writer can be shown to be as heroic and as notable as any of the astronauts' triumphs or any film stars' breakthrough performances. And that, for me, is the ultimate challenge. I think all the books have given me a different kind of satisfaction, one after another. Plays Well with Others is a book that I wrote very, very fast after burying 30 friends who died of AIDS in New York. And my goal was to write a comic novel about HIV, and I did. I don't know if it succeeds in all the ways I hoped it would, but it gave me an immense pleasure to write. And I really felt that I had all the friends I was seeking to honor standing behind me invisibly, sort of like the wind and the sails, saying, yes, tell it, hold nothing back. And I was reminded of things that I had forgot, and it somehow came out all of a piece. So every one of the books is different. The Practical Heart is a book that's taken 5 years to write, along with other things I've been working on. And I tried to conceive of four people who are as different from each other as possible, four voices that were tonally at variance, so that there would be no repetition in the book. And I think it really represents the best I can do at this moment. It's literally the best book I can write. My dad used to always tell us, "You boys, you just do your best. That's all we ask you." And this is the best I can manage. So I'm extremely proud of it.
Have any of your books been made into movies?
Yes, two have. Oldest Living Confederate Widow was a four-hour thing on CBS and won four Emmys and had, you know, Anne Bancroft and Donald Sutherland, and Cecily Tyson won an Emmy for her performance. And a novella from White People was made into a film starring Cecily Tyson with Peter Bogdanovich directing. And in both those films, I've had little walk-on parts, which has been a lot of fun to go to the set and just watch the process of movie making, which is both extremely exciting and extremely tedious, like a lot of life. And I feel I learned a lot about what it was like to be an actor just from having three or four lines. And in the case of Widow, getting dressed up in a Confederate uniform, which was a strange testosterone rush I hadn't expected to have. So it's been interesting. I think movies are so important to our culture, but for me, the book is still the holy of holies, and I don't.
Oh,
write.
What a beautiful saying!
Oh, absolutely!
Oh, I love that.
Aren't books the best? I mean, right
no,
now,
I mean,
I don't.
The book is the holy of holies.
It is.
Oh,
it
I
is. For me,
it.
It's the ultimate. I mean,
yes.
Especially since the 11th of September, I haven't wanted to rent movies and watch them. It feels somehow sort of like eating candy. It's like decadent, but I've been rereading Charles Dickens, and it's as if I've never read him before. It's given me such joy, I can hardly wait to get back to the page. So I think part of the beauty of being a reader is that you get to control the field of focus. You get to make the associations. You get to participate in the act of reading in a way that I don't really feel consulted when a movie is rushing over me. So I think there's a lot of spiritual hunger abroad, and I think books will be a way of bringing people back to their own best selves.
I wish I could get to Oak Park to meet you, but that's impossible.
Well, another time, I hope.
Have a good journey.
Right. Thanks very much. Oh,
we're almost out of time. I'd so wish we could keep going. One of the things I wanted to ask you to talk about maybe for a minute is this. It seems real clear, and you've commented on in some of the interviews that I've read, that for many Southerners, language is more than a form of communication. It is also a form of recreation. How do you think that informs your writing?
Well, the South was extremely underpopulated in the beginning days of our country, which meant that when people got together, they stayed and they told, and they came with their bags packed. There's still a long tradition in North Carolina of kids spending the summer at friends' houses, and that's from a kind of farm tradition that it was very difficult to get to another person. So by God, when you got there, you had a lot of time on your hands, and there weren't movies, there weren't any television, there was no television, and so you became the entertainment. And I think that tradition of conversation still holds. And what's marvelous about it, David, is that we're not talking about the requirement that you have a PhD in order to hold the floor. Any filling station has a philosopher sitting there on a broken down chair who can regale you with everything that's happened in the community for the last 80 years, all the sordid scandals and all the delightful jokes and all the witty things people have said. So I think that though we do have electricity now, thank God, there is something that lives on in that oral tradition. And I think being able to tell a very funny story or get off a good line is one kind of credential that still makes you a significant person in the community. So I think there's still a current of that that rolls on. And, of course, the King James Bible was mother's milk to us all. We grew up with the Bible and knowing a lot of Shakespeare and a lot of Dickens and a lot of Walter Scott by heart. And I think that leads you to believe that language is a purifying force in the world. It's not just a descriptive force. It's also a clarifying force that can make things right between people. And it's a kind of power. And I think one of the odd things is that losing the Civil War threw us even more back onto our own resources. Our monuments were burned, and we sat looking at the charred wreckage the way we all do these days. And we had to come up with a kind of valiant version of ourselves, our cause, and our value in the world. So I think that somehow persists even today.
Well, we'll have to stop. I appreciate very much you talking with us today and enjoyed reading Practical Heart a great deal. So I wish you the best, and maybe sometime in future we'll get a chance to talk again.
I look forward to that. I hope so. Next book.
All right. Very good.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Alan.
It's a pleasure.
Our guest, Alan Gurganis. The book here we've been talking about is entitled The Practical Heart, Four Novellas. It's published by Knopf. It's out now.